Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our first class on our brand new series, 20th Century Moments That Mattered, an exploration, a journey through the 20th century, and some major decisions, controversies, issues that arose that had consequences into the 21st century and likely beyond. Tonight, I have the privilege of presenting the first subject. It's not chronologically in order, but we had to schedule it this way, and that is the topic of the Daf Yom. On the right hand on our PowerPoint, if you're listening, the slides are hopefully online as well. We have today's Daf, Makos, Daf Tes Zayin. Makos, we're the Seder of Nezikin. We're in the order of interpersonal laws, damages. The tractate of Makos, dealing right now with different laws for which one receives lashes. And we're on page 16. That means to say that hundreds of thousands of Jews around the world, in countries and continents that span the globe, from different backgrounds, speaking different languages, dressing differently, appearing differently, behaving differently, with different types of yarmulkes on their head, in some communities, men and women, all were on the same page today. Makos 16. All over the globe, listening online, offline, reading, through every means of study, hundreds of thousands of Jews around the world were on the very same page today. By a show of hands, curiously, how many people learn the Daf? In this room alone, we have a wonderful showing. It's growing in popularity every year, every machzor, every cycle of the Daf. More and more are taking it on. It's hard to know the statistics and data, but easily it's in the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands around the world. How did this come to be? We take for granted. If you want to measure an established Jewish community, what do you look for? What do you want to know? Do they have a kosher pizza store? Do they have a Daf Yomi? For a long time, that's what you wanted to know. But when did Daf Yomi begin? When was it introduced? What is its background? What inspired and motivated it? And who is the extraordinary man? What is the story of Rav Meir Shapiro, the Lublin Rav, who had this very idea? That's our topic for tonight, a 20th century moment that mattered in an enormous way. Meir Shapiro was born the 7th of Adar, 1887, in the city of Shatz, Romania. His father, Rav Yaakov Shimshon, was a descendant of Nassim Shapiro of Krakow, the author of the Megala Amukos. He also descended from a great lineage of rabbis, the Mincha Shai, an important sefer, a grammar sefer on Chumash, on Tanakh. He was born into a significant time, the 1880s, the 19th century, the end of the 19th century. Government-supported, institutionalized anti-Semitism. It was growing, it was increasingly rampant, and Jews were already suffering from it in the end of the 19th century. Different Jews had different solutions how to resolve that growing problem. Many, the Haskalah, the Enlightenment, felt, well, if we'll just be less Jewish, then we won't be targeted or attacked for being Jews. So let's drop some of our Jewishness. It was against that backdrop and in that context that Rav Meir Shapiro was born, and that you see so much of his educational philosophy, so much of his vision, so many of his values are formed. Rav Meir Shapiro is a child prodigy. We throw that term around loosely. We did several years of People of the Book, and we studied great people, great minds, men and women. Almost all of them we described as geniuses, because if we were studying them, at some point, they made brilliant contributions to our Jewish literature. Meir Shapiro was legitimately a genius, a prodigy. He had a photographic memory. He knew Shas by heart. And we'll see in a moment, that was the standard he had for entrance, not all of Shas, but at least 200 pages into his yeshiva as well. At 9 years old, he passed the Bechina, a test for Smicha on Yoredeya. Just to give you perspective, that's the Bechina I have to be your rabbi, is on Yoredeya, Yore. He had smicha at 9 years old. It's not an apocryphal story. It's not something that happened centuries or millennia ago. He lived in the 20th century. And at nine, he was already distinguished for his brilliance. He was handsome. He was charming. He was a brilliant orator. I actually am very, very taken by the story of Rav Meir Shapiro. He's a role model for me personally. It's hard for me to even wrap my hands around or my head around everything he accomplished and all that he was. He was brilliant and successful in every arena, as we'll see in a moment. He was handsome, he is charming, he had a chaim, he was an orator, and he spoke Hebrew, Yiddish, he learned Polish, and whatever language he spoke in, he owned the audience he was addressing. He had a Hasidish orientation, he came from a Hasidish background, he himself lived a Hasidish lifestyle, but unlike whatever perhaps prejudice we might have, notion of a very narrow way of life, he was very broad in his thinking, in his learning, in his knowledge, in his experience. Meir Shapiro wrote poetry. He didn't just write poetry in Hebrew, he wrote it in Yiddish, and later he wrote poetry in Polish, which we have. He married at the end of 19, at the age of 19, the daughter of Yaakov David Breitman, the wealthiest Jew from Tarnopol. He was promised he'd be supported the rest of his life, which was an excellent plan. But Rabbi Beryl Wine points out the plan caved in when World War I broke out, and in 11 years after he was married, wiped his father-in-law, who was the wealthiest man, like so many Jews, wiped them out of what they had. That's a picture of Rav Meir Shapiro sitting at his desk. It looks like nice wallpaper, but that was a sarum. He had a very extensive library, which we'll come back to. His writings and speeches reflect a sense of mission. He knew at a young age that he had gifts. He knew he had talents. He knew he was blessed. And he didn't take it for granted. With a sense of humility, he understood that that gave a great responsibility. He felt a calling to be able to take all of his talents and skills and to impact the Jewish world in a very meaningful way. He also not only knew that he had talents and skills, but he felt that he was under the clock. We'll come back to it in a moment, but he was ill as a child, created heart problems at a young age. And he talked about if only he could live to 50, what he would accomplish. And unfortunately, he didn't. He died in his mid-40s, which we'll see. He became the Rav of Galina, Poland in 1911. He served there for 10 years. They were a rough 10 years because they required a lot of confronting adversaries, adversarial relationships. For example, he tried to institute kashrut standards, and the Jewish kosher mafia didn't appreciate it. He had death threats, but he didn't back down from the death threats. He was, like I said, a very assertive, charismatic leader, and it only made him stronger. He instituted in the town that Kohanim who weren't Shomer Shabbos couldn't duchen. That if a Kohen was not observant, he shouldn't ascend to duchen on the holidays. After he instituted that, the first Yontif came along, and the Kohanim who didn't fit the criteria, his new criteria, went up to duchen anyway. So he stopped the davening in the shul, he called them out by name, and he said, davening will not continue until they descend the bima and go back to their seat. How long would my job last if I tried something like that? Baruch Hashem, our community, we don't need to do anything like that. But I'm trying to give you a sense of his assertive leadership. He was fair, he was warm, he was kind, he was loving, but he was assertive, he was a leader. Again, he understood that he had responsibilities to take his talents and skills and to be transformational with it. Here's something incredible. 1922 elections were held for the Polish parliament. 35 Jews were elected. They represented over 10% of the Polish parliament, which made sense because Jews represented more than 10% of the Polish population. Out of the 35 Jews that were elected at that time, unlike today, where Jews can run as Republicans, Democrats, Independents, they're part of whatever existing parties, in those days there was a Jewish party. That Jewish party won 35 seats in that Polish parliament, most of whom came from Agudas Yisrael. The youngest of all was Rav Meir Shapiro. So the man is a Rosh Hashiva, he's a scholar, he's an orator, he's a community leader, and he's a member of the Polish parliament. He's a diplomat. Though he's one of the youngest members of the parliament, he distinguished himself with tremendous political diplomatic skills. He became the main defender of Jews against the openly anti-Semitic members of parliament. I mentioned that in the late 1880s, late 19th century, early 20th century, there's a growing hostility towards the Jews in Poland. We know what happens. That's not a surprise to anyone. He's feeling that hostility even within parliament. And there, like he didn't back down to the butcher and he didn't back down to the Kohen, he doesn't back down. The story is told, one of these Polish members of the parliament remarked there was a sign in a public park that prohibited Jews and dogs from entering it. Rav Shapiro retorted, I guess now neither of us will be able to enter the park. He had a sharp wit, and a sharp style, and an assertive leadership. He was invited to be a Rav in Warsaw. Warsaw is an enormous city, still is, enormously Jewish populated. The density of Jews in Warsaw, the percentage of the population of Jews in Warsaw was astounding. It represented a great opportunity to be the Rav of Warsaw. But reflective of his humility, Rav Meir Shapira turned it down because he realized just how large it was and thought he couldn't be effective in bringing about the transformational change, playing the role that he wanted to. 1921, he accepts to be the Rav in Sanok, where he founded two yeshivas, and I think this is fascinating. He founds two yeshivas simultaneously. Yeshivas Torah Va'avoda and Yeshiva L'Mitzuyanim. I don't know, educators today might be concerned with the stigma and the differentiation of which school do you go to and so on. But what were the purpose of the two yeshivas? Yeshiva Torah Va'avoda had learning until 3 p.m., and then they taught trades and professions like carpentry and printing. In that yeshiva, he had the equipment and he had all that was necessary to be able to train the bochur. This is a Hasidish Rav Rosh Yeshiva Gadol B'Yisrael who had vision. Today, maybe in that community you get in trouble for opening such a yeshiva. Then he already had the foresight and the vision to create Yeshiva Torah V'Avoda. That he understood that Torah needs derech eretz, it needs avoda. So learning to 3 p.m. is still a pretty rigorous schedule, right? But afterwards they would learn a trade and it would empower them to earn a livelihood. In parallel, at the same time, in Sanok, he opened the yeshiva for elite students from out of town. It was called Yeshiva L'Mitzuyanim. It was a yeshiva for the exceptional, for the elite. I'm going to guess that rather than create this class system which sought to demean those who were in Yeshiva Torah V'Avoda, Torah V'Avoda was the standard, but there was an elite yeshiva for the Mitzuyanim from out of town, a small group who had distinguished themselves with great capability and capacity that he would concentrate on. This was a forerunner to the Yeshivas Chochmei Lublin, which we'll learn about in a moment. He was haunted from a premonition, even at a young age, that he was going to die young. He had rheumatic fever as a child, left him with a damaged heart. He was prone to colds and illness, which only contributes to the astonishment about how much he did. If he had the flu or a cold, it was held back by his health. And yet, when we look at his short life, what he accomplished and did is literally astounding. Astounding. He was renowned for his strong leadership, for his warmth, and for his vision. 1924, he accepts a position in the great ancient city of Pietrikov. Anyone know who was a Rav in Pietrikov? Rav Yisroel Meir Lau, the former chief rabbi of Israel, current chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, a good friend of our community who's been here several times, his father was the Rav of Pietrikov, after Rav Meir Shapiro. And in fact, Rav Yisroel Meir Lau, the mayor in his name, he was named after Rav Meir Shapiro. In Pietrikov, he publishes a sefer of halachic responsa, Charles Achubas, called Or Meir. It begins to spread, and again, he's at a very young age, and yet, it earns a great reputation among his peers. He later wrote a second sefer, Imre Das, on Halacha and Agada. Some writings were lost, obviously, during that time, and the Holocaust. 1931, finally, he's appointed the Rav of Lublin, where he serves for the remainder of his short life. Lublin also is near Ma'in B'Yisrael. It's a great Jewish city with such famous people as the Chuzeh of Lublin, the Seer of Lublin. Lublin is a well-known and well-established city. He is the Rav of Lublin. This is the story. This is a very interesting story. It comes from the book about Rav Meir Shapiro, Blaze in the Darkening Gloom. It tells the following story. With a population of 3 million Yiddish-speaking Jews in pre-war Poland, there were many Jewish newspapers in the Yiddish language printed there. The two most prestigious secular newspapers were the Haint and the Moment, while the religious community printed its own newspaper called Der Yid. One day, walking by a newsstand, Rav Shapiro asked for Der Yid. The proprietor said to the great Lubliner Rav, "Why do you want Der Yid? Why don't you buy the more sophisticated paper? Why don't you read the Times or the Journal? What are you reading? Der Yid." I won't give a parallel. "In fact," he said, the newspaper owner, "Der Yid is all the way in the bottom of the pile. It's beneath the Haint in the Moment." Said the Lubliner Rav, "I insist on buying Der Yid." The proprietor bent down, he pulled out the paper from the bottom of the pile, he handed it to the Lubliner Rav, and he said, "I'm very curious. Why do you insist on buying Der Yid over Haint or Moment?" So Rav Meir Shapiro told him the following. He said, the name Heint means today. It denotes only one day. The name moment denotes likewise only about a minute, the here and now. So both will soon disappear in the past. They'll become irrelevant very quickly. But der Yid means the Jew. He may lie at the bottom of the pile, downtrodden and oppressed, but the Jew is eternal. He's here to stay. It's a great story of Rav Meir Shapiro, and again, it's reflective of his vision, who he was, the time they were living in, but his vision for the Jewish community. In Lublin, Rav Meir Shapiro is able to realize and fulfill his dream of building a yeshiva, something that he had been wanting to do, a growth, an outgrowth of the Yeshiva LeMetzionim, taken to the next stage. In Lublin, he wanted a prestigious elite yeshiva which would be modeled after Volozhin, Slobodka, Nevardik, and others. It would train anyone who wanted to learn there, but particularly Chassidish Rabbonim, to be the leaders of tomorrow of Polish Jewry. Similar to the vision of Torah Va'avod, Chochmei Lublin was not a place that you went to and you learned forever. It wasn't assumed to be a kol of life. The goal was to train the leaders of tomorrow, the elite leaders, the Gedolei Yisrael of tomorrow. In fact, this Tzur B'Mirabbanan is a certificate of graduation, a smicha certificate from the yeshiva. At the time the Chochmei Lublin was established, yeshivas across Poland, Eastern Europe, were places of poverty. The people, the pupils, the bachurim who went there were indigent. They wore tattered clothing. There was no dormitory. What's the Yiddish word? Teg. They would stay at somebody's home, and they would have to go eat in kest. They would eat in people's homes. I think it's teg. Kest is the meal. Okay.
Yeah.
They would have to scramble to find a place to stay, and scramble if someone's kindness would feed them, and they would wear their one suit the entire zman. It was known that Yeshiva Bachram lived the most simple, meager, poor lifestyle. For Rav Meir Shapiro, that was an anathema. It was contradictory to everything he believed in. If you're sitting and learning Torah, you shouldn't live in poverty. You shouldn't look as if you're falling apart. The opposite. The prestigious learning of Torah should uplift. It should be elevated. It should be prestigious. And that was the vision behind Yeshiva's Chochmei Lublin. He insisted on a yeshiva that would have a dormitory, that would serve meals, that would look beautiful. And here's how he interpreted the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Kachi dacha shel Torah. This is the way of Torah. Pas b'melach tochal, that we eat bread with some salt. Mayim b'mesura tishte, we drink a small amount of water. V'yala aretz tishan, and you sleep on the ground. V'chay etzara tichya v'torah ata amel. So classically, this mission is understood to mean that when you are immersed in the pursuit of the spiritual, you're studying Torah, the physical world is insignificant, it's unimportant. So who needs a fancy food? Bread and salt, a shtickle, a little something to drink, a piece of the floor to sleep on. That's all you need. Rav Meir Shapiro read the Mishnah very differently. Listen to how he read the Mishnah. Kach yidarcha shel Torah? Pas v'melech tochal? Mayim b'misur tishte? Is that the way of Torah? That all you eat is bread and salt and a little water and you sleep on the floor? That's not Torah. That's not a Torah way of life. So he builds the Yeshiva's Chochmei Lublin. That picture on the right is from the day of the inauguration of the Yeshiva. It was a magnificent building, 6 floors high, a large based medrash, a mikvah, a study hall, a dormitory, a modern kitchen, a bakery, dining room, laundry, infirmary, a reading hall, and a library with 40,000 sfarim. Chochmei Lublin. Yeshiva had, this also gives it some perspective. Jack and I were in the yeshiva in June on our BRS trip to Poland. Anyone else here who was with us? I don't want to leave anyone out. We were in the yeshiva's Chochmei Lublin. It was lost. The Nazis stripped it bare. They took all the Sfarim, 40,000 Sfarim, to the town center in Lublin and burned them. The Jews were crying so loudly that the Nazis brought in their band to play, to drown out the sorrows and cries of the Jews watching the prestigious yeshiva, the library, the 40,000 Sfarim being burnt. Afterwards, it was turned into a German military center. Then it was turned into a medical school. I've been in Poland four times. The first times I was there, it was a medical school. This last time in June, the Jewish community has brought back the yeshiva and reestablished the Beis Medrash. The dormitory is now a hotel, a four-star hotel, which is not a Jewish hotel. It's used to bring income to be able to maintain the yeshiva as the yeshiva. We were in the Beis Medrash. I gave a shiur that day's Daf Yomi in the Beis Medrash of Chochmei Lublin. It was an extraordinary opportunity, a real blessing, a real privilege. But the Beis Medrash is not large. If you've been to YU, you know that there's so many boys sitting and learning that they don't fit into one Beis Medrash. There's multiple Batei Medrash operational at once. If you've ever been to Lakewood, Beis Medrash Gavoa today is how many? 4,000? 6,000? It's many thousand. The Mir, this past summer I was in Israel with my father. We went shopping. I said, Dad, let's go to the Mir. You've never been there. I went to learn with him in the Beis Medrash. It was Bein Azmanim. It was between Tisha B'Av and Rosh Hashanah when yeshivas are off. We walked into the Mir at 11 a.m. and we couldn't find a seat. That level of diligent Torah study, the Beis Medrash is overflowing in multiple Batei Medrash. Thousands. Mir is the largest yeshiva in the history of the world. How many learned in the prestigious Chochmei Lublin? Never more than 200. 200. So the Beis Medrash is not so large. It's much smaller than the YU Beis Medrash, certainly the Lakewood Beis Medrash, and so on. The entrance exam to get into Yeshiva's Chochmei Lublin, again, this is not apocryphal. We're not talking about something that's centuries and millennia ago. We're talking about there are people who are still alive. Dr. Michael Michel, who was on our trip, a member of our shul, who lives in Muncie most of the year, is a cardiologist, has a patient who's 101, alive, soll sein gesund und stark, who was a Talmud in Yeshiva's Chochmei Lublin. In fact, when we went back to the yeshiva, he told Michael, Dr. Michel, where his makom, where his seat was, and said, please go back to my seat. I was pulled from it by the Nazis prematurely. Go resume the learning that I left off. Go back to my seat in the Beis Medrash and pick up that learning. An amazing, amazing story. So there's people alive who learned under Rav Meir Shapiro, the Lublin Rav, who learned in Chochmei Lublin, who will tell you the entrance exam to get in was 200 blat Gemara Baal Peh. 200 pages of Talmud by heart. By heart! You had to be able to say the Shakla Vatari, you had to be able to go through the Talmud. You know what one page of Talmud by heart is? Aramaic Talmud, intricate, back and forth. You know what it is to memorize one page? 3 pages? 10 pages? 200 blat Gemara? That was the entrance to get in, because he wanted elite yeshiva. The first graduation ceremony in 1934, 50 graduated as teachers. Rav Meir Shapiro did not live to see the moment. He passed away on the 5th of November, 1933. The cornerstone laying ceremony was 1924. 50,000 people came from throughout Eastern Europe in order to attend the cornerstone laying ceremony. 50,000! That's how prominent, how prestigious it was. The building opened on June 24th, 1930. As I said, the Nazis stripped the yeshiva, burned the vast library. After the war, it became a medical school. Today, that's the picture on the right. It is being reestablished as the yeshiva's Chochmei Lublin. Rav Meir Shapiro's last moments, and this comes from the memoirs of one of his Talmidim, Rav Yehoshua Baumel, who was killed in the Holocaust, but it was written in 1934, and we have his memoirs. I want to read it to you. This is just a summary of it. I'm reading to you the memoir of Rav Meir Shapiro's Talmud. He writes, the hour of night grew later and later. On a piece of paper, he asked that he be shown all the prescriptions that the doctors had written. When they were handed him, he went through them and selected the one for a preparation to cleanse the throat and the respiratory organs, and he asked that a new supply be gotten for him. Every few minutes, he kept washing his hands while his mind was obviously immersed in distant thoughts. The evident struggle that he had to make to draw breath was heartbreaking. One could feel the frightful, racking agony that he had to undergo to try to get a bit of air into his lungs. And try as he would, he kept failing, because the channels were blocked. On a piece of paper, he scrawled a request to be carried into another chamber, and he designated by its number, room number so-and-so. Interestingly, that room had two doors, each with the name of an organization that had contributed money towards its construction. One door bore the name of the Bikur Cholim Society of Chicago, and the other was the Chesed Shalema Society of St. Louis. When the transfer was accomplished, he asked for a change into a clean shirt and a fresh talus cotton, a fresh pair of tzitzis. Needless to say, his wishes were carried out. But then his wife, the Rebbetzin, noticed a change in his countenance. She began weeping emotionally. Rav Meir did his best to calm her, As he wrote the message, now the true simcha begins. In a broken, barely legible scroll, he wrote, "Let everyone drink l'chaim." Some liquor was poured out into tiny glasses, and all who were there drank and wished l'chaim to life. He shook hands with them all, one by one, holding each one's hand in his for a long time. And now he gave his instruction. Make a rikud, a chasidisha dance, to the words, Becha batchu avoseinu, in you our father trusted, and you rescued them. His wishes were obeyed, they joined hands, put hands on shoulders, they sang, by the way, to a tune he had composed, and lifted their feet in rhythm as they sang the holy words to the melody they knew well. It was clear that the end was approaching. Into the great shul, the young scholars came streaming to say Tehillim, to implore Hashem's mercy. As he noticed some of the dancing students sobbing, clearly and distinctly he pronounced two Yiddish words, Nor b'simcha, only with joy. And with that, he expired. He passed away, and his soul was taken from his body. He was gone from us. This was written by one of his Talmidim who was in the room, 1934. This was the story of his passing. In 1958, he's buried in Lublin. The Nazis desecrated the cemetery, but his tombstone survived. In 1958, his remains and that of his brother were transported to Israel. He's buried on Har Menuchos today. And in Israel, one of his students, Rav Yaakov Halpern, established a neighborhood in Bnei Brak called Zichron Meir for Rav Meir Shapiro. And within that neighborhood, a yeshiva was opened called Chochmei Lublin. Rav Shmuel Alevi Vosner, Zatzal, who passed away a couple years ago. Some of you know Jeannie Rab. Rav Vosner is Jeannie Rab's grandmother's brother. Rav Vosner was a Talmud of the Lublina Rav, a great posek, the Shevet Halevi, and a Rav of Bnei Brak of this neighborhood of Zichron Meir. Rav Vosner is one of the most prominent students of Rav Meir Shapiro. Another was Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung of Montreal. The great Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung was a Talmud of Rav Meir Shapiro as well. What's the story of the Daf Yomi? So I want to tell you now when he had the vision of the Daf Yomi and how he brought it into being. But I want to share with you a little bit first from a video. For the last year, Mashas in 2012, a video was produced. I'm only going to show you the first 3 minutes, but it has video images and pictures that will bring it to life. And against that backdrop, I'll tell you more about it.
It all began 89 years ago in Vienna, in August of 1923. It was the first Knesset Gedola, the first World Congress of Agudas Yisrael. The event brought together people from throughout Europe, including many of the greatest rabbinic leaders of the age, the Chofetz Chaim, the Ge'er Rebbe, Rab Chaim Oizer, the Chartkever Rebbe, the Ratzina Rebbe, Rab Moshe Mordechai Epstein of Slabodka, Rabbi Yisrael Zalman of Slutsk, Rabbi Yosef Lev Bloch of Telz, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Breuer of Frankfurt, and many, many others. The goal of the Knesset was to unite all segments of our people under the banner of Torah. And yet, there was an unexpected event at the Knesset, one that would unite our people in a way that no one had ever imagined. Rav Meir Shapiro was only 36 years old, by far the youngest of the featured speakers. He was the Rav in Sunik in Poland, a brilliant speaker, a charismatic leader, a spokesman for Torah Jews in the Sejm, the Polish parliament. With a loud, clear, enthusiastic voice, he presented his idea, the Daf Yomi. He gave an example of a Jew who takes a two-week journey from Eretz Yisrael to New York, and under his arm he carries with him his Gemara, learning his Daf Yomi every day. He arrives in America, and the very first morning that he walks into a Beis Medrash, he sees fellow Jews learning the very same Daf. He happily joins them in their learning and establishes an immediate rapport with strangers who are now his Chaverim. Can there be a greater expression of unity and harmony? What is more, said Rav Meir Shapiro, there are many mesechtas that very few people learn. Thanks to the Daf Yomi, these mesechtas would no longer be orphans. When the Chofetz Chaim heard this, he rejoiced. And he said to Rav Meir Shapiro, "When you come to the Olam HaEmes, all those lonely Masechtas will come out to greet you." His listeners at the Knesset were electrified. But would this idea take hold? Or would it just join many other wonderful and imaginative ideas in the dustbins of history? Now, it is the first night of Rosh Hashanah in the Beis Medrash of Ger. Tens of thousands of Hasidim have come to spend Rosh Hashanah with the Heilige Imrei Emes. That evening, the Rebbe asks his Gabbai to bring him Masechta Brachas because he's about to start the Daf Yomi. The word spreads like wildfire. The leader of the largest Hasidus in the world is learning Daf Yomi. Within minutes, every Masechta Brachas in Ger is in use, and people are waiting in line to use them next. For the rest of the 1920s and 1930s, Daf Yomi grew more and more popular. And fittingly, the mass celebration of the first Siyum HaShas was held in 1931 in Rav Meir Shapiro's own city of Lublin. There's 5,000 people. Each Siyum HaShas inspired thousands all over the world to start learning the Daf. And here we are tonight, the largest Siyum HaShas in history, where a great American palace of sport has been transformed into a sanctuary of the spirit. Tonight, in the presence of close to 100,000 people,
This was shown at the 2012 Siyum HaShas at MetLife Stadium in Meadowlands and around the world. It's 15 minutes long. I only showed you 3 minutes of it. BRS is Daf Yomi. There's a picture at the end of the video that includes our Daf Yomi. So I want to give you a background a little bit more in depth, reviewing some of the same things Rabbi Kron said on that wonderful video that has some images that bring it to life. The proposal was made on the 7th of Elul, August 19th, 1923. The resolution was adopted 3 days later on August 22nd. This was at the first General Assembly of the World Aguda in Vienna. As was said on the video, many Gedolei Yisrael from all over the world were there in attendance. Rav Meir Shapiro was 36 years old. You talk about a moment that mattered, a vision and a dream that's altered the course of Torah learning and communities and Batei Medrash, and he was 36 years old. He was a Rav in Sanaka at the time, and he proposed that with the coming, this was in Elul, he proposed with the coming Rosh Hashanah, the Daf Yomi begin. And on September 11th, that year, at least an auspicious date, 1923, Jews around the world would begin learning the Daf Yomi. Rav Meir sat on the Convention's Committee for Education and Strengthening of Faith and met in a private session. And it was at that private session that he first shared this vision, this dream. We're going to talk about in a moment where he got the idea, what brought it about. But it was in that setting, in the small committee. And the response from the other members of the committee, great rabbis, some were enthusiastic, but many were lukewarm. We like to celebrate it as an amazing story, but some actually opposed it. And why would they oppose it? What are the arguments to oppose it? You could dumb down learning. You know, I started the Daf with the last Machzor, with the recent cycle. Haven't missed a day yet, Baruch Hashem. And it's all it's cracked up to be. On the one hand, you can't go a day without learning because you will not close your eyes till you did the Daf that day. On the other hand, not every day is that learning of such high quality. When you first open the Gemara at midnight after a long day because you refuse to go to sleep without it, sometimes you fly through the Daf. The learning can be at a lower quality. So some people said, it's way too fast. A Daf a day, it's an insane speed. You can't learn it, you can't retain it, you can't plumb the depths of it. So some were enthusiastic, but some opposed it. And yet, they agreed, you know what? Run with this idea, and we'll see what happens. So they told him, say the idea not in the name of the committee. It's your own idea. So much for consensus, right? It's not, you're on your own. Make a proposal at the end of the report on your own. And when Rav Meir Shapiro got up and made the report, as you heard it said on that video, this is what he said. He painted this picture of a Jew traveling in a ship, and he travels across the world, and wherever he goes, he has his trusty Gemara. Something will obligate him to learn every day. And wherever he goes, even if he doesn't speak the same language, he speaks the language of that day's daf. So if you live in Boca, but you travel to Paris, or to London, or to South Africa, or to Brazil, or to where Israel, it may be French, or Spanish, or Hebrew, or any other language, but when you open that Gemara, you're talking the language of the Gemara. The capacity to unite the Jew wherever we are. And it was effective. The Ger Rebbe adopted it right away. After Rosh Hashanah davening that night, he opened the Gemara Brachos, and when Hasidim see the Rebbe do something, immediately he had all the Ger Hasidim on board. The Chavetz Chaim also came on board. This came about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. You know the picture on the cover of every Shmiras HaLashon book? Every poster for the Chavetz Chaim, don't talk gossip? That's not what the Chavetz Chaim looked like. We don't know where that picture came from. That was not what he looked like. There was one picture we had of him sitting with a cap on in a chair, or like almost on a bench, outside of his little store. It was the one picture of the real Chavetz Chaim. A few years ago, someone was going through archives, and they came across a video of that first Knesset Gedola that we're talking about, and the Chavetz Chaim walking in. Now, I want to play that video. It has no sound, but we all know so much about the great Chavetz Chaim. At least let's picture him accurately. Let's see this great man. The short man who's being held. That's the Chavetz Chaim with his arms crossed, looking down humbly. Being protected. Being protected to the point that now they cover the camera and push him away. That was it. That's the only footage, and it only was discovered recently in an archive. Fascinating. The Chavetz Chaim said the following about Rav Meir Shapiro. He said, "You've done a tremendous thing, and in heaven they're greatly rejoicing because of your initiative. You should know that there in the world of truth it is the study of Torah that is most respected. Every Jew merits being honored in relation to the amount of Torah he studied in this world. In the world to come, we don't say, 'Welcome, Rabbi Yaakov,' or 'Welcome, Rabbi Chaim.' Rather, it's 'Welcome to the one who studied Brachos. Welcome to the one who knows Masechah Shabbos. There in heaven, there are thrones of glory for those who study Torah, and engraved on each throne is the name of a tractate, Brachos, Shabbos, Erevin. In the world to come, each person is seated on the throne of the tractate he studied. Consequently, not long ago, there were many empty thrones. For those who studied Torah only studied the Masechtas they came across in their younger years, what we call the Yeshivish Masechtas. And so many others were neglected. But now, because of the proposal of Rav Meir Shapiro, the Daf Yomi, the thrones of all the Masechtas will be filled, and the joy in heaven will be beyond measure. And that is why you deserve the greatest congratulations." This is what the Chavetz Chaim told Rav Meir Shapiro about his initiative. Daf Yomi has 2,702 pages. That's a lot of pages. That was the original version. When they used a smaller edition of Masechah Shkalim, that was the only first cycle. Since the second cycle and beyond, we added a few more pages just because of the pagination of Masechah Shkalim. And now it's 2,711 pages. What's Cal Ripken Jr.'s record? Anyone know? How many games did he play in a row? I don't remember. Anyone know Hall of Famer Cal Ripken Jr.? Nobody knows. Somebody Google it while we're here. It wasn't 2,711. It's an enormous number. And it wasn't, you know, Cal Ripken Jr. had days off that the Orioles didn't play. To take on the Daf Yomi, to commit to that learning, is, for one cycle, 2,711 days in a row. Do you know anyone who makes a commitment for anything for 2,711 days in a row? Could you imagine if it weren't the Daf, but you tell a friend, "You know, I have this initiative I want to work on, and I'm taking it on, I'm making a pledge to follow through." Really? How long are you going to do it? A week, a month, a year? 2,711 days in a row. Not missing a day. That's the commitment of the Daf. There's 37 Masechtas, it's the Talmud Bavli. It's called the Daf. A Daf is made of two Amudim, the front, it's a folio page, the front and the back. Right? The Talmud is numbered, not the way we read a book. We read a book that every page has a page number. The Talmud is numbered by folio pages. So today, Makos, Tezayin, Tezayin represents both sides of the page. So it's Tezayin Amud Aleph, Tezayin the front side, and Tezayin Amud Beis, Tezayin the second side. There's a first side and a second side. So a daf are the two sides together, or a blat is a Yiddish word. It takes 7 years and 5 months to complete You could do the math. That's 2,711 days in a row, is 7 years and 5 months. That's quite a commitment. Where did he get the inspiration for the daf? Where did it come from? He played 2,532 games in a row? Not the daf. He went to finish Shas. If you learned a daf every day Cal Ripken Jr. played, you wouldn't have finished Shas. That's, Shas is a greater commitment, and Cal Ripken Jr. is the standard for consecutive playing. What was the inspiration? What made Rav Meir Shapiro, what made him dream of introducing the daf? A 20th century moment that mattered, transformed the lives of people in this room. By the way, it didn't just transform our lives. Since I started learning the daf, it has changed the life of my family. My children see me learn, they see I have a chavrusa. If we're flying, if we're on the road, if we're on vacation, they know Abba can't go to sleep. Did you do the daf yet? Did you not do the daf yet? Oh, you're listening to the daf if we're in the car. When is your chavrusa coming to do the daf? It transforms an entire family. It's an enormous impact. And it requires the support of a family. Because to do the daf takes a minimum really of an hour a day. That hour could be spent with a spouse, with children, with other activities. To be able to spend that hour a day requires the support and the partnership. The real heroes of the daf are those who encourage their spouse to wake up early in the morning or to go out late at night and to learn the daf. The daf is an incredibly potent force. It's transformational, not only for the one learning it, but for their family, for their entire sphere. So you talk about a moment that mattered. For the, I don't know, third of the people in this room, maybe more, who raised their hands, they learned the daf. That moment still matters for us now, 100 years later. What inspired him? So shortly after, he had an interview with a newspaper, and he told the following story. This is a paraphrase from the newspaper. He said, "As I traveled to the Knesset Gedolah, a heavy question appeared in my mind. It disturbed me tremendously. I didn't have an answer. I pondered for hours, but I couldn't come up with the answer. Until I actually stood in the Great Hall of the Convention, I remained lost in thought. How can we possibly host in one hotel all Gedolei Yisrael from all circles and different backgrounds? How can Reb Chaim Brisker connect with Reb Yaakov Rosenheim, the president of Aguda from Frankfurt? Can a modern American youth sit comfortably together with a Yid from Tzfas? Can a Torahdik, a Litvisha, a Dutchman go along with a Hasidisha from Poland? What could bridge the differences? If the theme of that Knesia Gedola was unity, in anticipation and build up to it, he was haunted by the thought, how can we be united when in fact we have such diversity? At a loss for an answer, I decided to open my Gemara. He says, I opened my Gemara, brachos, I began to learn. And I reached my first question on the Gemara, I had another question on the Gemara. So I began to explore Rashi, Tosos, the Marsha, the Maram. And when I put it all together, I understood the Gemara, I got the pshat. On the spur of the moment, he says, it occurred to me. The Mishnah was written in the days of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi in Israel. The Gemara was written centuries later in Babylonia. Rashi lived in Mainz. Tosfos lived in France. The Marsha lived in Lithuania. The Maharam Lubliner lived in Poland. And yet, all these diverse backgrounds come together to explain the Gemara's question. What can unite our differences? He came to the conclusion when our conversation is centered around Torah. If you get into politics and what kind of yarmulke and schools and a million and one other things, you're going to be divided. But if your conversation is on Torah, you'll be able to be united. If you're lost in the daf, when there's all kinds of forums and groups and WhatsApps and chats and Facebooks and Twitter where people are talking about the daf and it brings together the most diverse group of people from around the world who can hardly agree on anything. But when they're talking about that day's daf, they're speaking a common language. There's a fraternity. There's a bond. There's a unity. And he realized that was the solution. How this enterprise would be successful, this Knesset Gedolah v'Agudas Yisrael, how would they achieve unity? If we can have a conversation that revolves around Torah. That's one story of what inspired Rav Meir Shapiro to introduce the daf. A second story. This is an amazing story. Let me read it to you. The sage with the shiny face alighted from the train, drawing glances of admiration to the waiting crowd. His radiant countenance, his regal bearing, his warm smile combined with the brilliance of his words to draw the adulation of Yidden everywhere. He was a respected Rosh Hashiva, an influential community leader, a passionate voice in the halls of Polish Parliament on behalf of Jewish causes. He was a Rav of one of the most celebrated communities in Poland. What made him a household name, however, was the ingenious, innovative plan that he had conceived that we would learn the Daf Yomi. The people thronged around Rav Meir Shapiro and lined up to introduce himself as he smiled warmly, sharing an encouraging word with us. Each one of the Jews in the train station that day was a distinguished young Rav who took the opportunity to say Shalom to the Lublino Rav. He introduced himself as the son-in-law of the Shatzer Rebbe, a name close to the heart of Rav Meir, who had grown up in the town of Shatz. Rav Meir looked at him thoughtfully and asked a strange question. Right? Today, they wouldn't tell this story that he asked this question. He said to this young rabbi, is your wife here with you? The young Talmid Chacham replied that in fact she was. Rav Meir Shapiro said, can I speak to her? I want to see her. So this young Rav went to get his wife to rush her over to the famous rabbi who had introduced the Daf Yomi. The Lubina Rav stepped to the side and lowered his gaze. And for a moment, the look on his face was like that of a child. He addressed the woman that stood before him. He said, do you recall how as a small child, I would learn with your father in your home? The woman replied that she remembered those days very well. Do you recall how I would play with your siblings and yourself after we were done learning? And the woman again replied in the affirmative. Only a most astute listener could have discerned the slight tremor in the Rav's voice as he continued. Do you recall how I would share my grandiose plans about how one day all Jews in the world would learn the very same Daf of Gemara, a Daf Hayomi, and be connected in the most powerful, meaningful way? And maybe, the Rav's voice dropped to whisper, maybe you recall how all the children would laugh at the idea and mockingly call me the Dach Hayoma, deriving immense satisfaction from the joke. And the woman didn't reply. Do you know that I came very close to losing confidence in the plan and dropping it entirely as a result of those taunts? This is the reason that I asked to meet with you. I want to tell you one thing, he said to her. Never laugh at the dream of a child. Never mock the dream of a child. Years later, someone repeated the story in the company of the great Gaon, the Posek from Yerushalayim, Rav Moshe Halberstam. Someone present, raised his doubts as to the veracity of the story. Said it couldn't be true. The Rav smiled and said he knew the story was true. You see, the woman at the train station was my mother. So it's a true story. And it reveals that Rav Meir Shapiro was dreaming of it even when he was a child. Maybe it came together on that train to the Knesset Gedola, but that notion, that idea already began to percolate as a child. And I love that image that he tells this girl that he grew up with years later. She's a Rebbetzin of a Talmud Chacham. He's the great Rosh Hashiva. And he says, remember when we used to play together? Never, ever make fun of the dream of a child. The real credit for the Daf Yomi goes not to Rav Meir Shapiro, like most good ideas in Judaism. V'schus nashim tzidkaniyos nigalu. It's only in the merit of righteous women that we've been redeemed, that we'll be redeemed, that most good things come. And so the same is true with the Daf. The Daf is really the result not of Rav Meir Shapiro's vision, but the credit really belongs to his mother. When Rav Meir Shapiro, this appears in Rabbi Fran's book, in 1894, on Isru Chag Pesach, the day after Passover, when young Meir Shapiro was 7 years old, he saw his mother was crying. Mama, why are you crying? Because your Malamed, your teacher, didn't come today, she said. He was supposed to come, but he's not here yet. So why are you crying? He'll come tomorrow. He was here yesterday. Why are you crying? He didn't come today. You don't understand, Meirla. You're too young. You don't understand. But if you miss a day of learning, it can never be replaced. His mother said to him, she was crying that he was missing a day of learning with his Malamed. And she impressed on him that if you go a whole day without learning, if you miss a day of learning, it can never, ever be replaced. That penetrated his heart and certainly, obviously, ultimately emerged as his idea. Create a system where a Jew would never, ever miss a day of learning. The Daf Yomi. The real credit belongs with his mother. The first Siyum HaShas took place February 2nd, 1931 in several cities in Europe, in America, in Baltimore and Philadelphia, in Yerushalayim, and the main Siyum was in Rav Meir Shapiro's Yeshiva in Chochmei Lublin. 1997 was the 10th Siyum, there were 70,000 participants. 2005, the 11th Siyum. There were 120,000 in the United States, 300,000 around the world. You may remember Madison Square Garden. Maybe some of you were there. 2012, the 12th Siyum. We actually broadcast it live in this room. MetLife Stadium, which holds close to 100,000. The Meadowlands, another 20,000. Satellite broadcasts around the United States, all over the world. And for the 12th Siyum Hashas in 2012, it was also broadcast where? In yeshivas, back in yeshivas Chachmei Lublin, in the yeshiva of Rav Meir Shapiro. Is there a greater statement of triumph over the Nazis, over Hitler, than the Daf, a Siyum Hashas, the 12th cycle being celebrated back in the yeshiva where it all began, in the yeshiva of Meir Shapiro? And get your tickets, because the next Siyum Hashas, the 13th, is January of 2020. There are different ways to learn the Daf. You could obviously learn the Gemara alone, you can learn with a Chavrusa. You could attend a shir. You could dial a daf. I still remember images of Yocheved's grandfather, her Zaidi, Zichron Levracha, who every day would sit with the telephone and speaker. Anyone remember the dial a daf? You could dial in this phone number. That was a technological wonder at the time. You could dial this phone number, and then you could press whatever number for Hebrew, English, Yiddish. Everyone in the house would be going crazy. Are you almost done with the daf? I need the phone. You couldn't be on the phone because there was no cell phone. The full phone was tied up for the hour. Someone was doing the daf. The daf was on CDs and tapes. Today you could learn online. Shiurim are available in shuls, at home, and offices. And these two pictures are the Long Island Railroad. The last two cars departing Far Rockaway, 7:51 a.m. and 8:15 a.m. There are daf yomis that meet on the train every day from Far Rockaway to Manhattan. Those are two pictures of the daf being learned on the train. Some of the things that revolutionized, that really contributed to the proliferation of the daf, one has to give incredible vision, incredible credit to Art Scroll, Rav Meir Zlotowitz, who passed away this year, and Rav Shnosson Sherman. 1990 to 2004, it took 15 years, 73 volumes, the Schottenstein edition of the Talmud Bavli, published by Art Scroll. Over those 15 years, it was timed that the volumes would be released when the Daf Yomi was up to it. Cost over $20 million to produce Art Scroll's Shas, Talmud Bavli. It's been translated. The Art Scroll Shas is in Hebrew, is in French. Art Scroll now has an app on your phone, on your iPad. You can have all of Shas at your fingertips. More recently, Koren has begun to spread the Talmud based on Rabbi Steinsaltz's translation and Rabbi Steinsaltz's initiative for the Daf. We have more tools than we've ever had at our disposal. More opportunities, more ways, more tools, more instruments, more avenues to learn the daf than ever. Rav Meir Shapiro didn't only inspire the Daf Yomi that fateful year, but the Daf Yomi itself has inspired many other Yomis. Mishnah Yomis, Nach Yomi, Yerushalmi Yomi. The Ger Rebbe in 1980 introduced Yerushalmi Yomi, takes 4 1/3 years. The Mishnah Torah Yomi was introduced by the Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1984. You could either do it in a 1 year cycle or a 3 year cycle. The Amud Yomi, if the daf is too fast, don't do both sides of the page. Do one side of the page a day. It'll take 14 years. Mishnah Berurah Yomi can be 2.5 or 5 years. And there are countless daf resources. Obviously, Agudas Yisrael, who originally endorsed the daf and hosts the Siyum Hashas. The OU has Shiurim online, a whole daf center. YU Torah has numerous daf yomis a day. There's a Daf HaChayim, which is an incredible resource. If you have an iPad or the computer, you go to dafachayim.com or org, I forgot which, and that day's daf, or you can go look at any previous day. It has, like, as if someone were writing on a chalkboard, visually is giving you the daf as you're listening, as you're learning it. You can learn the daf visually, audio, read the text of it, a million and one ways. There's something called daf notes, kolal iyun hadaf. There's a daf digest. There's the lumdus on that day's daf. We have 3 daf yomis a day at Boca Raton Synagogue, proudly. Rabbi Sugarman in English at 7 a.m. Rabbi Asher Esabag in Hebrew after the Sfardi Marav, the Arvitich night, and Stuart Silverman in English as well. 3 chances to learn the daf yomi live and in person every day. And there's not only men who attend the daf yomi, anyone who wants to take on this great task. I want to end with what I think the real legacy and contribution of the daf yomi is. The real awe and admiration we should have for those who go through the daf. They go through the daf, and we hope the daf goes through them. But what is the real legacy? The first Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, Krakow, 16th century, the first Rama in Shulchan Aruch, He writes, the Machaber, the Shulchan Aruch says, Yisgaber ka'ari lamad baboker, wake up like a lion to greet the day, and adds the Ramah, Haga, v'al kopanim lo ya'achar zman tefila, don't come late to davening, and shivisi Hashem lenegdi samid, hu klal gadol batorah. What is the most important principle in the Torah? That you place Hashem before you, tamid. What does that word tamid mean? Always. The first Ramah in all of Shulchan Aruch, in all of Orach Chaim. The last Ramah in all of Orach Chaim, the last Ramah in the sixth volume, at least of Mishneh Berurah, at the end of Orach Chaim, he's talking about Purim Katan, if you have 2 months of Adar. And here the Ramah says, you know what you should do? Mikom makom, yabe kitzas b'su'udah kidei letzis yimei machmirim. That you should make a little su'udah, even on Purim Katan, the Purim of the first Adar. It's not the real Purim we observe in the second Adar. But make a little su'udah. Why? Tov lev, mishte, tamid. He quotes a pasuk from Mishlei. Because tov lev, mishte, tamid. Someone who's good-hearted is always ready to have some mishte. Is always ready to have a party. What's the word that the Ramah both begins and ends the Orach Chaim section of Shulchan Aruch with? The word tamid. Shivisi Hashem lenegdi tamid. And he ends tov lev, mishte, tamid. Why do you think he brackets the laws of daily living with the word tamid? What's the significance of that word tamid? Where did the Rama maybe get that from? Perhaps he got it from this medrash. The Ein Yaakov, Yaakov ibn Chaviv, quotes a medrash. No one's been able to actually find this medrash in the midrashic literature, but he quotes a medrash, and he says the following. There was a rabbinic convention of the Tanaim, 2nd century Israel. The rabbis got together, and they debated what verse in the entire Torah should be the motto, the bumper sticker of the Jewish people. What verse best captures what the Jewish people are all about? Ben Zoma said, Shema Yisrael. There's no pasuk that says it better than Shema Yisrael. This is the words on the lips of Jews who were martyred throughout history. Shema Yisrael, the unity of God's existence. That's it? That's the pasuk. Ben Nana says, nah, that's not the pasuk. You know what captures, encapsulates the totality of Judaism? V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. Zekla gadol, that's the whole Torah. Comes along Rav Shimon ben Pazi and he says, no, that's not it either. You know what it is? The real bumper sticker, the motto of the Jewish people is, Sakeves ha'achad taseh b'boker, v'sakeves ha'sheni taseh ben ha'abayim. This is a pasuk that says that we bring the daily offering, one in the morning, and one in the evening, the daily offering. In the Mishkan, later the Beis HaMikdash, there was a daily offering. Rain, sleet, snow, Shabbos, Yontav, Yom Kippur, weekday, it didn't matter. There was a daily offering in the morning, there was a daily offering in the evening. They took a vote, says the Medrash. And which verse did they endorse as being the one that best captures what Judaism is about? Shema, V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha, or the Korban Tamid, the daily offering? Very surprisingly, they voted the daily offering. You can't help but wonder, says the Maharal. Really? That's the most important verse in the Torah? Shema, I understand. My loyalty, my faithfulness, my fidelity to God, the unity of His existence, my service of Him. Loving God's children, I understand. Selflessness, giving. The daily sacrifice, Korban Tamid. That captures what Judaism is all about. And the Maharal says, the Maharal writes in the Sivus Olam, says the Maharal, yes. Because our ability to live with consistency, you're not truly serving Hashem. You can't fulfill Shema, and you can't be living V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha if you can't live Tamid. If you have no consistency in your life, if you can't create a pattern and a habit and a ritual, if you can't live with Tamidis, then you're not living either of the others. So that's the most important verse. The foundational verse is Keves Achad in the morning and one in the evening. That to me is the greatness of the Daf Yomi. You know, we have rituals in Judaism. We have to daven 3 times a day. We have time bound mitzvahs. We have things that obligate us. But nothing ever obligated us to Torah learning. We had the general principle of being Koveya Itim the Torah. We had the general idea that one should set aside time for Torah learning. But the idea that I feel obligated, I feel responsible, I've taken on a commitment, I have to learn the daf every day. I won't go to sleep without doing it. Maybe I'm listening at double speed to the podcast. Maybe I'm reading it in the English rather than the Hebrew. Maybe, doesn't matter what time of day, doesn't matter what responsibilities I had that day, I don't close my eyes without the daf. That creates a sense of being tamid. A tamid that we should be in awe of. Awe of Rav Meir Shapiro for introducing the daf, awe of those who learn the daf. And this is the secret from going good to great. Jim Collins in his book Good to Great says, sustained great results depend upon building a culture full of self-disciplined people who take disciplined action and are fanatically consistent. A culture of discipline is not just about action. It's about getting disciplined people who engage in disciplined thought and then take disciplined action. The good to great companies appear boring and pedestrian, looking in from the outside. But upon closer inspection, they're full of people who display extreme diligence and a stunning intensity. Daf Yomi can take you from good to great. It has taken our people from good to great. And so in summary, Meir Shapiro was an extraordinary human being, snatched from us way too young, didn't even make it to his mid-40s. But his legacy, his contribution, the Yeshivas Chochmei Lublin, the Sfarim he wrote, but nothing more than his Daf Yomi. One man with a dream, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands around the world united, all on the same page, speaking the same language because of his vision. He has enabled all of us to go from good to great. Thank you very much.